Not everyone is excited about the idea of a cleaner Chesapeake Bay. 21 attorneys general from other states are suing to block Maryland's Chesapeake Bay cleanup efforts. We'll be talking about that with Rona Cabell in today's edition of Midday on the Bay. Also, we'll hear about a new oyster dragnet that's getting the worst poachers off the waterways, and about a new technique for getting nitrate from farm runoff out of the water, an interesting new process involving wood chips. Plus, environmental legislation in Annapolis, for better or worse. It's the February edition of Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell, coming up after the news from NPR. Welcome back, everybody. Dan Rodericks here. Welcome again to Midday on the Bay, our monthly collaboration with the Chesapeake Bay Journal. You can subscribe to the Chesapeake Bay Journal and get free delivery or just read it on the web at bayjournal.com. We're about midway through the annual 90-day Maryland legislative session, and environmental advocates are checking priorities off their list. They fought back challenges to the stormwater law, which we discussed here on Midday a couple of days ago. They're continuing to push against hydrofracking for natural gas in Western Maryland, and they're lobbying for more clean energy. But almost every year, there comes a bill for which a constituency is hard to identify. Who, for example, benefits if we have arsenic in our chicken feed, or if we don't know what pesticides we're spraying? So we're going to talk a little bit today about these bills and why it takes so long to kill them, or in some cases, pass them. Also on the show, we talk about these 21 attorneys general from other states suing to block Maryland's effort to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. We'll find out what that's all about. We'll be talking about a new oyster dragnet, that's getting the worst offenders off the waterways, and about a new technique for getting nitrate out of the water that involves wood chips. Rona Cabell always has interesting stuff for us here on Midday on the Bay. Rona Cabell, veteran environmental writer with the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and joins us here once a month for Midday on the Bay. Nice to see you again, Rona.
Thank you. You too.
It's quite a lineup you have here today. We have a lot to talk about. But I'm going to put the phone number out, because as we go along through these subjects on Midday on the Bay, if you have a question about one of them, just give us a ring, 410-662-8780. You can find links to Rona's stories, about the wood chips and the bioreactor, which we're going to talk about later on in this hour. That's on my Facebook page, and that'll provide you a link to the Chesapeake Bay Journal. You can also submit a question or comment about any of the subjects we address today by email, midday@wypr.org. Okay, so Rona, a fun topic, the legislation always is. So tell us a little bit about this and why you wanted to talk about these bills.
Well, every year you see the same sort of battle lines drawn in Annapolis. You have your land conservationists, your clean water advocates, your climate change groups, and they're all lobbying for legislation to clean up the water and the air. And then on the other side, you have your real estate agents, your farm lobby, and your local officials pushing back. A lot of times, even if you don't agree, it's easy to see both sides. Mm-hmm. For example, I think every new home that is not on public water should have a denitrifying septic system.
Denitrifying,
which means taking the nitrogen out of the waste that humans excrete, the liquid waste, mm-hmm. And cleaning it so that when it goes into the bay, it is not full of nitrogen, which is a pollutant. But okay. To do that, it will add several thousand dollars to the cost of the home.
So if you're a home builder
or a real estate agent, that home becomes harder to sell. So mm-hmm. even though I don't agree, I can see where they're coming from. But sometimes you have these bills where it's really hard to see where you're coming from.
I get you. So that's what you're talking about here. With some legislation, you look at them and you say, well, who would oppose this? Or who's supporting this? That's what you mean?
That's what I mean. And a good example of that would be the recent bill to get arsenic out of chicken feed. Chicken companies...
I can't believe we're even talking about this.
I know.
This, but, okay.
Well, can you believe it took 3 years to actually do it?
Arsenic.
So chicken companies gave their flocks this drug called Roxursone, which supposedly helped the chickens become healthier and less susceptible to disease. It was basically an antibiotic. But it's a carcinogen, and it began showing up in the chicken's poop, which the farmers use as a fertilizer. And then it got in the waterways, and then it got in other crops. And there's been a lot of hubbub about it getting into apple juice, which is mostly consumed by children.
So Roxursone.
Roxursone.
R-O-X-A-R-S-O-N-E.
Right.
So that has a component of arsenic?
That has a component of arsenic. So in 1999, the European Union banned its use, and they're always a little more progressive than we are about banning these things. And then in 2007, Purdue banned it, and then Tyson voluntarily stopped using it.
Oh, well, that was a good thing.
That was a good thing. And then the FDA, which could force companies to stop doing it, simply decided instead to ask them to stop using it.
Let's be nice and ask. We won't force you to remove arsenic or Roxasone. We'll just ask.
We'll just ask. So a lot of companies were no longer using it, but at any point they could go back to using it. They could use a different brand if they wanted, and it was completely legal to use it. So a lot of citizens groups just wanted it out of the chicken feed.
Okay. So then we have a legislature who actually comes along and says what we're saying here as we sit here, like, why is this allowed anymore, arsenic in chicken feed, right?
Right.
So someone put a bill in?
Right. Tom Hucker of Montgomery
County. Tom Hucker, good guy. Yeah.
He put a bill in. He tried for 3 years, and the poultry industry and the pharmaceutical industry fought against it. And even companies like Purdue, who said, we're not using it, they fought against it because they didn't like the principal of Annapolis telling them how they could run their poultry company.
Isn't that crazy? So they voluntarily gave it up a while ago, but they didn't like there actually being a law saying you couldn't use it.
Right.
I don't get it.
So
what finally tipped the scales in?
Well, it was decided that, hey, maybe we should figure out whether or not this arsenic stuff is really bad for you, because there's inorganic arsenic, there's arsenic. The poultry companies were saying this isn't a problem. So the legislature commissioned the University of Maryland Center for Agroecology to do a study to determine if this arsenic was harmful and if it was getting into the waterways. And the answer on both counts was yes. So after that study was completed, then the bill finally passed.
But it's kind of a reminder there that the FDA in that looks pretty bad.
Right.
A reminder that the FDA maybe doesn't speak up for us as much as it should.
I think it's a reminder that all of these agencies don't speak up for us as much as they should.
Department of Agriculture would be another one.
Yes, yeah. The EPA. I think people assume, they continue to assume, that the government is here to help us. What they don't understand is that the government is often hamstrung by legislation and lobbying that weakens rules, and that a lot of these agencies are terribly scared of being sued to exert their authority. So they don't exert it so much as sort of ask, recommend, and companies are free to ignore that.
So when I asked before about tipping the scales in this story, what tipped the scales? Was the study by the University of Maryland? What was it? Was it citizens groups? What was
it? I think
it
was those two things. I think it was citizens groups pressing against this, led by Food and Water Watch out of D.C., and also, I think it was the study acknowledging that this is harmful and that it's getting into waterways and other crops. And I think the third thing is just our general increased knowledge of toxins and how they migrate, and just understanding that, you know, hey, it isn't good for us to consume these things.
And is Maryland leading the way on this, Rona?
Maryland, believe it or not, was the first state to ban arsenic in chicken feed.
Unbelievable.
So as much as it's unbelievable that we...
In 2013, 2014.
2013. Yeah. So as much as it's unbelievable, you have to wonder what, say, the Louisiana state legislature is letting through.
Let's move on here to what you call these no-brainer bills. You call them no-brainer bills. Legislation that you can't imagine anyone opposing or anyone not supporting. Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean.
All right, give us some examples here. Let's start with pesticide reporting.
So the pesticide bill has been interesting. This is a bill that would create a database of all the chemicals that farmers spray. So the Maryland Department of Agriculture has this information, but it's not available to the public. So over the years, there have been various iterations of this bill. Either a database available to the public, or a database available to public health officials only, or state officials only. And the latest is a $10 increase to the fee of big companies that sell products in the state, like Dow Chemical and Monsanto and Bayer. Those are the three of the biggest companies that are manufacturing these pesticides and herbicides, that would fund a database.
So the Department of Agriculture, meaning the Maryland Department of Agriculture, they have a database already?
They have knowledge. The farmers submit to them when they're spraying, what they're spraying. And okay. if there is some kind of an outbreak, they can go back and ask the farmers, hey, did you spray something? Because there's a public health concern in this area. But
why don't they just make that available to the public online or something?
Well, at the moment, it isn't really in a database form. It's farmers in the field writing down on note cards. And so it's not really available to the public. And I don't really know, because it's not available to reporters, what exactly they have.
Okay.
So
boy. All right. So they put in a bill asking the big companies, Dow, you mentioned Monsanto, Bayer, to support a fund for a database. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So how's that looking this year?
Well, the first hearing, the industry didn't oppose it, so it's possible it will succeed. But again, Dan, this is a question of, I think, a greater awareness by the public. There are groups like Moms Rising, and not environmental groups, just concerned citizens who are asking the question, what's in our water? What's in our air? There's a greater understanding that these pesticides, which are really toxics, a lot of them, what they're doing to our water. We've got intersex fish. We've got intersex frogs.
Slow down. Intersex. So, meaning
intersex.
We talked about that.
Sorry.
That's like the smallmouth bass that showed up in the Potomac.
Right.
Male bass with female organs.
Yes. And we're seeing it in frogs in the Midwest. A lot of these frogs are showing both testes and eggs. So there's obviously something going on, and we're not entirely sure what, but they're making connections between the large-scale spraying of pesticides. And in fact, in some cases, crops are planted kind of pre-sprayed. They have the resistance within them. So it's extremely difficult for an animal to overcome that. So
what are they worried about there? Farmers are just worried that this brings increased pressure on them, increased scrutiny, that the public doesn't know what's best for them or something like that. What's the attitude there?
The Farm Bureau is
trade secrets. Well,
some of it is that. Some of it is they don't think this information should be made public because this is how they manage their farm. The Farm Bureau told me this is a huge burden for farmers because it's so much more work to come in during your busy time when you're out spraying your apples, to come in and get on your computer and log on and write what you're spraying and how much you're spraying.
That's such a pain in the neck, isn't it?
And the third,
especially if you can do it online with the Department of Agriculture. I mean, wouldn't that be nice?
Or from your smartphone, just in the field. And then the third thing is, I think people are worried about panics, that somebody starts to get, a stomach ache or headaches, and then they automatically assume, oh, it must be the farmer.
Right.
And that could open the way to lawsuits like that poultry lawsuit that, it's intrusive to people. So there's that concern on the farmer level.
But you're looking at this. I guess you're taking a side on this. You're thinking better reporting is better than not reporting.
I think it's always better to have more information than less information. I think it's good to know what's going on in the air.
All right. One other piece of legislation we want to talk about here before we take our first break on Midday on the Bay with Rona. It brings us back to black liquor, which is really take your time and explain this to folks, because this is a great story about industry and concerns about green energy and the environment and the way laws are made in Annapolis. So let's go over this. Start with Mike Tidwell. He plays a role in this.
He's with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and he calls this one the mother of all incomprehensible legislation. He's the one who's largely been, there are other people, but he's the one who's kind of leading the fight, his group. So the story goes like this. In 2004, environmental groups worked hard to pass a renewable energy standard. So power companies in our state buy a certain percentage of fuel from renewable sources. This is to kind of get the renewable industry off the ground, give it a market.
Mm-hmm.
So we think of these things as wind, solar, geothermal, and largely good things. But the paper industry managed to include one of their practices in the standard. It's the burning of waste that's created in making paper. Mm-hmm. So it's a carbon dioxide-rich tarry, and it's called black liquor.
And it's called black liquor because it looks like a black syrupy kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay. So they were burning black liquor, long before the standard came in. You said, what, 2004?
Right. So they've been burning the black liquor since the 1930s.
Okay.
It's just that getting it into the renewable portfolio made it possible to get paid for it. So it's kind
of... Wait a minute. How is this a renewable?
Well, because you're using waste. You're using
waste. You're using waste from some other process
for
additional fuel, for additional energy.
Right.
So that's how it qualifies.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
You might call it more of a beneficial use of waste rather than a renewable.
Okay, but they've been doing this for a long time.
Yes, and I should add that not only is black liquor a renewable fuel, but also incineration, now burning trash, has been added to the renewable standard. So as a result of black liquor being available, there is much less demand for wind and solar because companies can just buy the black liquor credits and then they don't have to, you know, try to find something else. So it satisfies their renewable needs.
Okay. I've been out to Western Maryland. I've been past this big paper mill out there, right, in Luke,
yes,
I think it is,
the
right?
New Page Mill in Luke.
New Page, yeah. Is that the only one in Maryland?
It's the only one in Maryland.
That would benefit from this?
Right. And the bill was written to basically exclude Luke from the black liquor ban. So it was saying, Luke Paper Mill, you can still burn the black liquor. You can still get credit. You will be grandfathered in. It's just that the out-of-state paper mills in Ohio and Indiana will no longer be able to get our renewable credits.
Okay. Is it bad that they burn black liquor? Is it environmentally bad?
It's not great that they burn black liquor, but it's probably not the worst thing you could do.
But it's carbon dioxide rich.
It's carbon dioxide rich. It's just not a renewable fuel. It doesn't meet the spirit of what a renewable fuel was supposed to do. And they will burn the black liquor regardless of whether or not they get the incentive. So why not give the incentive to things like wind power and solar that are really still trying to get their sea legs?
Okay. So just... to wrap this up then, the bill that came through Annapolis on this.
Right.
Asked for what and what happened to it?
The bill asked that black liquor be taken out of the renewable standards portfolio.
Okay.
You could still burn it. It just wouldn't give you renewable credits. Luke Paper Mill agreed to it, but shortly before the bill came up, Luke reneged and said, we don't support the bill anymore. It failed to get out of committee by one vote. The opposition to the bill came from unions and from the paper industry out of state saying, you know, we want options. We think this is a good option. We think the renewable standard should be broad so that should you want to buy black liquor credits, you can.
Right. You can burn black liquor. It's just a question of whether you get credit for using it as a renewable and if it benefits the environment.
That's right.
It doesn't sound like it does.
It doesn't sound like
it
does.
So we're not going to give you credit for it.
Right.
Right. All right. Thanks, Rona. All right. We're going to move on. We got some other issues to cover here on the show. Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell. A new oyster dragnet, a novel way to reduce nitrate from farms, and a lawsuit from out-of-state attorneys general trying to stop the Chesapeake Bay cleanup, if you can imagine that. Midday on the Bay continues in just a moment. A short break. 410-662-8780 is our number. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here, Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell in this hour. So, wait a minute. Before we move on the black liquor legislation, is it still current in Annapolis?
Yes. In fact, there was a hearing today on it at 1 o'clock, I think.
On whether they were going to allow it to be considered a renewable.
Yes. Yeah. And the governor O'Malley, supports it, as he did last year.
Supports
it being taken out of the renewable standard portfolio.
All right, I get it now.
So he supports the bill. We'll see where it goes.
The Maryland Natural Resources Police have been making the news lately. I saw this on Channel 13 on WJZ, a big oyster bust. The DNR stopped a truck out on Route 50 near Easton. It was filled with the undersized oysters. I put a link to the WJZ story on our Facebook page. At least four repeat offenders have lost their licenses to harvest oysters permanently. Rona calls this new law enforcement effort, the oyster dragnet in the Chesapeake Bay, and she's here to tell us a little bit about the oyster dragnet. This is interesting. Rona, what's going on?
Yeah, so I call it that because I'm trying to rid my life of acronyms. There are just too many. And it is really called M-Line, which stands for the Maritime Law Enforcement Information Network.
Oh, I prefer oyster dragnet. Yeah, I'm with you on that one. So tell us a bit about how
the Oyster Dragnet works.
So it's a camera, radar, and computer system combined. And basically, the communications center people have a map of the Chesapeake Bay, and on it, they can see everything they need to see. So they can see the boundaries of oyster sanctuaries. They can see buoys, longe lines, and most importantly, the boats. So there are 9 cameras that are trained on the bay to give real-time images of what's going on. And there are several different ways that police are using this. They can see the boats on the water. So if they notice a boat at 2 in the morning, they can click on that boat and see what kind of vessel it is. And if it's an oyster boat, they might wonder why it's out there, you know, during non-kosher oystering hours. And an officer can go to the dock and meet the boat and see what they've got. That's happened. It also triggers an alarm. So they don't actually have to be watching the computer. But if a boat goes into a sanctuary, an alarm will sound. And then a patrol officer can get out to the closest dock and meet the boat and see what's going on. And
interesting. This is all done with computers, radar, GPS.
Yes.
All of that. By the way, you mentioned a couple of things. First of all, oyster sanctuaries. Now, I don't want to assume everybody understands what that is. The state declared certain oyster sanctuaries a few years ago, right?
Right. We've always had oyster sanctuaries in Maryland, but there's been this push to change how we do them. So they're larger and they're more vast. And now it's very clear to the watermen where they are, whereas it used to be they were sort of patchy and all over different places and it was a little hard to tell. Now there's large areas of the bay that are off limits to oyster harvest because they're sanctuaries. So if a boat goes into, I think the Miles River is an oyster sanctuary. So if a boat is in the Miles River at 2 a.m. and it looks like it's not supposed to be there, the police can see what they're doing. Parts of the Nanticoke also are sanctuary.
And they can see what's going on there even without watching because
That's right.
they have these alarms now.
Right.
You use the term lat long lines.
Yes.
What are lat long lines?
The latitude and the longitude, just like on a map.
I'm sorry. I thought it was a way of harvesting oysters.
Sorry,
now.
I got a little too sophisticated there.
I got an oyster on the line right now. I'm sorry. Thank you for explaining that to dumb Danny here. Okay, so is the system working, and how long has it been in place? How long has this been going on?
So I first started writing about it in 2009, and it took them a while to get all the equipment, and they were working with the Navy to get the system in place, and it cost about $5 million from Homeland Security. And
Excuse me. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Homeland Security?
Yes, I should back up. So the system
Homeland Security is now aiding the protection of oyster sanctuaries in the Chesapeake Bay?
Well, yes, but that isn't what it was. The system was not originally for Oyster Dragnet.
They got oysters asking for asylum?
Right, oysters want to come
sanctuary!
To this country.
Sanctuary! Sorry.
So the first job of the system was to protect the Baltimore Harbor. This came out of the Homeland Security. And we have also the Dominion, the Cove Point nuclear power plant on the bay. And we've got ships coming in and out. So it's important
you
to
You mean Calvert Cliffs?
Yeah, Calvert Cliffs. So it's important to watch what's going on. And the LNG plant that we've been talking
about.
Cove Point, yeah. So there's important things that we need to keep an eye on the bay that we really weren't watching. So the first job of the system was to protect the Baltimore Harbor and watch what was going in and out. And then they realized that was also an excellent tool for catching oyster poachers. And then the third thing that the system does is it is a law enforcement tool and a rescue aid for local law enforcement departments. For example, Anne Arundel County Fire Departments used the system several times to help locate people and rescue people. Hmm. There was a fishing party that decided to jump in and take a swim, and their boat drifted away, and they helped use the M-Line system to find them and rescue them. And a bunch of law enforcement agencies, Baltimore County, Anne Arundel, several, are getting into a partnership with M-Line so that they can have access to certain information that's useful to them. So
it is... Multiple uses of the Oyster Dragnet.
Multiple uses. So the Oyster Dragnet is kind of the part that interests us as Chesapeake Bay Journal, but that isn't... that wasn't the real reason to have it. It was part of the reason.
Now, I need to ask you about this. When it comes to poachers, I mean, there have been poachers in the bay for a long time. There have been rockfish poachers. Remember
right,
that?
Right.
So, you know, in the past, it always seemed that these guys would break the law, and time again, they get a slap on the wrist. The judges, especially over on the Eastern Shore, didn't take it very seriously. And you mentioned that some of these guys lost their licenses for good. So are they getting tougher on this, or have the penalties increased?
Yeah, and that's been a huge, huge help. A few years ago, the department worked with Anne Arundel County to create something called the Oyster Docket. And they have one prosecutor handling all natural resources violations cases, not just oysters, but, you know, fishing with the wrong weapon, you know, any of these kinds of things. And so when you see these cases all day long, when you're seeing all natural resources cases as opposed to an assault and then an oyster case, you tend to take them more seriously. And it's been extremely helpful to have the oyster dockets, and other counties now have these dockets as well. Even counties like Carroll, where there really isn't any oystering, have these natural resources dockets where one judge and one prosecutor help hear the cases. It also has helped somewhat that some of the judges and the prosecutors also are fishermen, and they know this is a problem, and they would like to do something about it. And then the third thing that has been important is a few years ago, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources went to the legislature to get stiffer penalties. And so it used to be that even at the very worst, an oysterman could get a $500 fine. That'd probably be it. But now, if you're oystering in the middle of the night and you get caught with oysters from a sanctuary or undersized oysters or just being out there in the middle of the night, you can lose your license. And I think that has been a huge deterrent.
And the courts have actually taken away licenses.
Oh, yeah. Well, DNR, yes, the courts have ordered that, and DNR has made it happen. Yes.
Let me ask you this, Rona. As far as oyster poaching, and we had these big rockfish poaching schemes a couple of years ago, big netting of rockfish out of season and all that. Do you have any insight as to where they're going with this stuff? I mean, are oysters that are poached in the Chesapeake ending up in restaurants in Baltimore or people's homes here? Are they going out of state? Do we have any insight on that?
I think that they are going out of state. I think New Jersey, you know, places that are not as aware of the restrictions that we have. Now the Department of Natural Resources has this new oyster buyer's license. So they want people to be able to say, if they've taken any free seafood or made any trades for seafood, where it's come from, to try to get more accountability so that if you have a license to get X number and this is what you caught, but yet you're selling Y number, you know, what accounts for the discrepancy? So I think it used to be a kind of a very vague area, frankly. There wasn't really a lot of transparency, but that is increasing. And I also think that the poaching that you mentioned, the rockfish poaching, that became a federal case. And I believe that there was prison time involved.
Yes, it was.
So, you know, these things are becoming much more serious. And I think that...
And it's being taken seriously.
It's being taken seriously.
So when I mentioned at the beginning here that those four licenses, those were just temporarily taken away. They were permanently taken away. So
right. And those guys had, one of them had 24 violations.
Oh, the repeat offenders.
They were people that were... Their names were known to the department. Let's say it that way. They were people who have been arrested over and over again or cited over and over again for violations. And, you know, one thing that the watermen used to always say to reporters is, oh, it's just a few bad apples. It's just a few people doing, you know, 90% of the bad deeds.
I remember Larry Sims, the late Larry Sims.
Yes.
Who was president of the Watermen's Association. He used to say
that. Right. He used to say that.
Yeah.
So I tend to think that that's true. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it exclusively true, but the people who tend to be the repeat violators, it's a small group of people. And, you know, there's degrees. I mean, there are people who occasionally might have some undersized oysters, and maybe it's an oversight. But to actually take oysters from a sanctuary is kind of a different bridge. So these people who had their licenses permanently revoked were doing things that the department felt... I don't think that decision was made lightly. I think those are people who were repeat offenders.
Have you talked to any of those offenders?
I have talked to one of them, but not since
I'd be curious what they're all about. I'm sure they're about trying to make some money. But I'm sure there's also sort of a libertarian anti-establishment bent a little bit there. They don't like all these rules. They don't understand why you can't just go out and harvest fish and oysters without all these restrictions.
Well,
I think that, I mean, because I've heard some of that. Yeah.
Yes, but with the sanctuary, I mean, those oysters are not the public's. Those oysters are the state of Maryland paying millions of dollars to replenish an oyster population.
I understand, but yeah. I don't think they get that.
Yeah, and interestingly, Virginia is having a lot of trouble with poaching. And one of my colleagues went out on a boat and they caught a guy who had a bushel of what they call boxes, which is empty oysters, oyster shell with no live oyster in. And she wasn't sure, and neither were the police, whether it was an oversight or whether he was intentionally trying to defraud a seafood buyer by taking worthless oysters.
Right, yeah.
And they gave him a citation. And the police said, you know, we expect to see him back on the water doing the same thing. We'll keep an eye. So, I mean, I think that it, you know, it, these guys are really struggling to make a living. And they may see that this is...
They haven't figured out a new way to make a living. There's only so many oysters and so much fish that can be harvested by so many people.
Well, aquaculture is a new way to make a living.
Yeah.
But that requires... an investment. It requires an entrepreneurial bent. And frankly, it's not for everyone.
So. Is the word getting out about this oyster dragnet now that might be tougher to pull this off? I guess these arrests have been kind of high profile. I mean, they were all over television with this one from Easton.
Well, that's one of the watermen I spoke to for a story that I'm writing next month. He was upset about that. He said it's embarrassing that they're putting it all over social media and making us look like a bunch of crooks.
You mean the ones who were arrested?
Well, no, the whole community.
The whole community,
right.
Well.
I mean, you have a community of, you know, 1,000 people,
yeah.
And it's a small community, and you have somebody breaking the law, and it's plastered all over the media. But I do think that, you know, their use of social media and to get it out there is a deterrent, because it is embarrassing.
I agree. Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. It's midday on the Bay. We'll take another break. When we get back, you got to hear about this lawsuit to stop the Chesapeake Bay's cleanup, to stop Maryland's effort in cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. This is rich. 410-662-8780. If you have a question about any of the subjects we've covered with Rona Cabell in this hour of midday, we'll be right back. Back with Rona Cabell, midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here, 410-662-8780. Midday's email address, midday@wypr.org. You can go on my Facebook page to find links to the Bay Journal, bayjournal.com, Rona's articles about the subjects that we're covering here. And also, I want to note that the website has been overhauled. It looks really good.
Thank you.
I mean, it looked good before. It looks better now. And there's more blogging going on about the Chesapeake Bay, about with environmental news at bayjournal.com. So that's excellent. And you can also get a newsletter delivered to your email box, right? Of the top stories. You always have some interesting stuff in there. Excellent staff.
You.
Very good. And thank you for being here again, Rona. Before we leave the oyster dragnet story, I'm just curious. The sanctuaries are being hit by these poachers. What about all the oyster farming going on? Are any of the farmers having poaching problems?
We're not seeing too much of that. And two reasons for that. One, I think people do recognize that that's another man's living. It's his property. And the other reason is I don't think it's quite as easy. A lot of the oyster farms in Maryland are what we call the spat on shell. So they're just oysters on the ground. But we do also have some floats and we have cages. We have oysters growing in cages. And it's a lot harder to take the oysters in the cages because you'd be using a dredge. And that would be obviously difficult to get the oysters because they're, you know, locked up. So it hasn't been as much of a problem. It is a little bit more of a problem in Virginia. They've had aquaculture a lot longer than we have.
So they are seeing some poaching
issues? They are. I don't think it's nearly as much as in the public fishery.
Now, I want to talk about this lawsuit. First, I heard about this last week. One of our listeners tweeted us about it, and I thought, what is going on here? First of all, before we do that, I want to talk about this other story on the bioreactor. I mentioned that earlier.
Sure, yes.
Rona had this story. This is one of the stories that's posted on our Facebook page. So let's explain this one to folks. This involves wood chips and runoff from farms.
Yes.
And how wood chips might be used in preventing all that nitrate runoff.
Yes.
And then we'll get to the prize story, which is these attorneys generals trying to stop the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay. But anyway.
Yes.
Tell us about what's a bioreactor?
So it's this box, basically, of wood chips. And what happens now is it rains, and the rain moistens the soil and runs off into the rivers and streams. And the farms, especially on the eastern shore, are all flat, so it just runs right off.
Mm-hmm.
This device, called a bioreactor, collects the water into a pipe and then funnels it into a trench. And the trench is in the trench is this box filled with wood chips.
I saw there's a picture of it on the Chesapeake Bay Journal.
Yes. Yeah. So the water goes in. The wood chips convert the nitrate in the water into a harmless nitrogen gas, And then the water goes out the other side much cleaner. And then it has a lot less nitrogen in it. And
so,
then,
so excuse me, the wood chips are underground?
Yes, they're underground in this trench, in this box. Mm-hmm. And so they're basically digesting, I guess you would say, the nitrate and turning it into, it's a chemistry process.
So the farmer needs to steer the runoff, the water, into this box and then into the underground.
Yes.
And then it goes through these wood chips.
Yes.
Or it settles in there.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And where did you see this being done?
So this was being done, it's being done right now on two farms in Maryland. One is in Caroline County and one is near Ruthsburg in Kent County, the northern part of Kent County. And these two farmers got help doing this from a riverkeeper, the Choptank riverkeeper, Drew Coslow, and also some federal and state help. And they're just trying to see right now if it works. They're going to be monitoring it. And if it turns out that it is effective, it will become available to more farms.
And where did it come from? Was it developed here?
It was developed in Iowa.
Iowa.
They have a big farm research center at Iowa State. It was worked on there. And then a couple people brought it to Virginia Tech. And 2 years ago, Virginia Tech put it in a farm on the Eastern Shore called Painter, Virginia, which is a research farm that one of the universities in Virginia operates. And it seemed to work pretty well. And so, you know, the riverkeepers and the state are always looking for new ways. Since we've kind of done the easy stuff on farms, they're looking for new ways to attack these problems. And a few years ago, they started doing these ditch control structures where they could, like, control the water level that was going on into farms so that you could basically bank water and it wouldn't all run off. And so now this is sort of step two of that. And it seems like it's going to work pretty well.
Sounds promising, Rona. Now let's turn to the lawsuit. 21 attorneys general recently filed a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief, in a lawsuit that the American Farm Bureau Federation filed this goes back a couple of years,
yes.
Right? Okay. So you got 21 states joining in here. Now, this is the suit that says that the EPA, what, has no authority over cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay?
That's right.
All right,
it's the state's job.
So why are these states getting involved? What are they worried about?
Well, plain and simple, they're worried that this cleanup is going to work so well that they're going to be forced to take the same steps and clean up their waterways. They're terrified that the federal government will make them do what it's arguably supposed to do, which is to force the Mississippi River and every other drainage basin to maintain certain standards, to be swimmable and fishable and available to everyone and not just a polluting ground for industry.
So they want to... These attorneys generals, their states are worried that they're going to have to do what's being done in Maryland. For instance, stormwater fee is part of this, right?
Yes.
They're worried about that kind of stuff?
I think they're mostly worried about this is a Farm Bureau Federation lawsuit. I think they're mostly worried about farm things like controlling manure, controlling runoff on farms, reducing the amount of phosphorus that's going into the Chesapeake. They're worried about these things because they don't have those controls in the Mississippi River Basin. And the Gulf of Mexico has one of the largest dead zones anywhere. And it's because of these fertilizer issues. And they don't want the EPA to come in to their states and say, you have to clean up.
I'm sorry, but that just strikes me as ridiculous. Why is the EPA there? And isn't it true? And I mean, wouldn't you say this is true? I don't think anyone's biased in saying this, that the enforcement of pollution laws in the Chesapeake Bay haven't been great. And that the EPA finally put its foot down and said, we're going to step in here and force the states to do something and they did it by applying this, enforcing this limit on pollution, right?
Yeah, and the other thing to remember is this has been a collaborative process. It isn't like the EPA came in and said, all right, this is the law. From tomorrow on, you know, you have to do X, Y, and Z. What the EPA said is this voluntary effort that we have, surprise, surprise, isn't working. So we're going to give you all, that's why they call it the pollution diet. We're going to give you all targets that you have to meet. We're going to give you all a plan. And the states came up with their own plans. They submitted their plans to the EPA and said, here's what we think we can do in our state. Here's what's reasonable.
Right.
And none of the states, other than West Virginia, have joined this effort. In fact, Maryland has said, O'Malley has said, he's going to ask Doug Gansler to file a brief in favor of the EPA, because he doesn't think that the other states should be telling Maryland and the six other jurisdictions in the watershed how we can clean up our waterway.
Is Pennsylvania involved in this?
Pennsylvania, it's the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau that started the state, but Pennsylvania
started what?
Started the original lawsuit. The Pennsylvania Farm Bureau.
Oh, great. All right, like they're not involved in the Chesapeake Bay watershed?
Right, but the state of Pennsylvania hasn't opposed the cleanup, and they're on board. I mean, they're doing things. They've got manure management laws. They're working on it. Oh. I think everybody's working on it. Maybe not West Virginia.
Everybody's working on what?
Everybody's working on a cleanup. Everybody's working on following the plans that they submitted with the EPA and doing things like reducing manure. That's where this whole...
So you're saying there is an effort in the watershed, in the states of the watershed?
Yes. I mean, I think long ago the states decided, you know, we should get on board with cleaning it up. Rather than spend millions of dollars fighting it, let's put that money into cleanup.
Okay. But you and I get 21 attorneys general, not from Pennsylvania.
Not from our watershed, other than West Virginia.
Where are they? Where is the heat of all this? Who's leading this effort against? Who's filing this suit? I understand who filed the suit was the Farm Bureau Federation.
So the attorney generals, the Kansas attorney general filed the brief.
Kansas.
He's very tight with the Farm Bureau and the national agriculture groups. The Florida attorney general has been very active in supporting it. And a lot of the Florida editorial writers have been all over her about, you know, if someone told us we couldn't clean up the Everglades, how would we feel about that? We'd be pretty mad. We don't have any right to tell other states what they can and can't do. So a lot of people are very upset about it, as you could imagine, because we're actually trying to do something here. And to be told that we can't do it is kind of infuriating.
Federal Judge Sylvia Rambo? What was her part in this?
So she...
And where is she?
She's in Pennsylvania. She's federal judge in Pennsylvania. And the suit was heard by her, and she ruled in favor of the EPA on almost every count. And this is what's really interesting to me, because I cover a lot of agriculture versus the EPA lawsuits. And in my experience, agriculture often wins. So this was a rare, complete defeat for agriculture. And I think that's why they decided to try to get these attorneys general on board to say to the appeals court, which is in Philadelphia, hey, this isn't just us industry people. Other states are also concerned that the EPA is overstepping its authority.
Local government, state government doesn't like it either.
Right.
Oh, boy. So now in this state, Governor, Governor O'Malley done about this? You said he's asked Gansler, the attorney general?
Yes, he's asked Gansler to write a brief in supporting the EPA. And because Governor O'Malley is also head of the Chesapeake Bay Executive Council, which is the governing body of the six states on the Chesapeake Bay issues, he's asked all the other Chesapeake Bay states to also file briefs in support of the EPA and in support of this what they call the total maximum daily load. So when the judge does hear it, he's going to hear from states that are doing it that say we're doing it and it's good that we're doing it.
Well, it's just ridiculous, the idea that an attorney general in Kansas can ask that anyone would support his view that Maryland should not try to clean up the Chesapeake Bay because of the standard or the legal standard it accepts, that the EPA has authority. I mean, why should somebody in Kansas have any say over what we're doing here?
Well, that's
isn't that the ridiculous part of it?
To me, that is the ridiculous part. And, you know, what we're fighting for here is clean water and a better environment. So that's what the EPA is trying to do, and that's what the states in the Chesapeake region are trying to do. And it does seem to me that they're earnestly working on it. You know, we have the Maryland Department of Agriculture really taking a stand on phosphorus. Now, they haven't really gotten anywhere yet, but they're trying. They say this total maximum daily load is forcing us to reduce our phosphorus. We're going to do it. We're going to find a way to reduce phosphorus coming off a farm field. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for this regulatory hammer, I'm not sure they would be doing that.
And the subject we discussed the other day for an hour on midday, this stormwater implementation of the stormwater fee and stormwater projects, we had explanations of that on the show the other. That's part of that as well.
I personally don't think that the stormwater would have passed if it wasn't for the TMDL, this regulatory hammer. I think
the EPA is saying you can only allow so much pollution in the bay per day.
Right. So you, Maryland, and you, Virginia, have to figure out where you're going to make the cuts.
Okay. And the EPA took this action a few years ago pretty much, well, the Obama administration said, we're going to take this position. We're going to really push here, because the record over the last 25 or 30 years wasn't so great.
It wasn't so great because local governments, a lot of it was voluntary. And so when you have a lot of other priorities, environment often falls by the wayside. Not necessarily because, you know, the governments hate the environment. It's just that, you know, you've got other priorities. And if it wasn't mandatory, they weren't going to do it. So they made it mandatory. And as I said before, I do think that there is an earnest effort, because it's mandatory, to attack the problem.
Just for the record, these 21 attorneys general represent states not in the watershed.
Not in the watershed. We've got Florida, I think Michigan, Wisconsin, Kansas, Missouri. They're mostly in the Mississippi River watershed and then the Gulf of Mexico.
And they're arguing that the state should not accept the EPA's authority.
They're saying that the EPA is overreaching its authority, that the EPA, that states should be regulating the environment, which, you know, if you think about it, so Maryland has one environmental law, West Virginia has another. What is the fish say that has the pollution, you know, that's being affected by this pollution? Oh, it's okay. In Maryland, we'll prosecute someone. But when that fish goes to West Virginia, it's no longer a problem. I mean, you have to regulate these things federally, or you just
interesting
you have
legal argument. Like, do we have any say over what happens in the Mississippi River? I mean, it does cost all American taxpayers for flood control, right? So, I mean, that's a different issue. There's not so much it doesn't have to do with pollution. It has to do with flood control, right? So you could argue, well, if Mississippi, state of Louisiana doesn't take care, if the federal government doesn't take care, it's going to cost us all later in flood control that we'll have to pay for. So you need to take precautions now. So you could argue that there is a national interest in that resource.
I don't think you would see Doug Gansler, if the Mississippi River decided that it was going to clean up its act, I don't think you would see Doug Gansler file a brief saying that they shouldn't.
Right.
I mean, it is just not the business of states that are not near there to tell the other states what they can and can't do.
But what I'm arguing is that Chesapeake Bay, there is a national interest in having an estuary, this large estuary, be clean. Coastal areas to be clean, for less pollution to spill into them. I mean, we have the Clean Water Act.
Well, if there's a national interest in that, these states are arguing against that interest because they're saying, no, we don't want you to clean it up. We want the states to make their own decisions, which they were doing for 25 years to not much success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't think that the EPA should have a hand in this, but it really isn't their business. And I understand what you're saying. If it's there have been lawsuits between states when it comes to, like, the regional greenhouse gas initiative, that some states aren't participating and not pulling their fair share. But this is different. We don't even share any borders with other than West Virginia, which decided to enter this friend of the court brief as well. We don't really share any borders with these states. You know, we don't have
West Virginia.
We don't have common.
I just love the attitude toward the environment in West Virginia. Anyway,
after we see what's happened there, I mean, with the, you know, with the recent environmental atrocity, mm-hmm. and the inability to drink the water, you would think maybe they might think, hey, EPA involvement, maybe that's a good idea. But doesn't seem to have swayed any hearts and minds, has it?
No. We're going to keep an eye on this with the 21 attorneys general. Thank you very much, Rona. And I hope the Oyster Dragnet works out, because I'm looking forward to having more Maryland oysters someday on my plate. Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. You have another story you posted today?
I posted a couple blogs about black liquor and about these no-brainer laws. They're on our blog, and we have a Facebook page, so please check in. We update it every day.
BayJournal.com.
BayJournal.com.
Thank you, Rona.
Thank you. It's
Rona,
a pleasure.
Yep. Rona Cabell joins us once a month for Midday on the Bay. That's our midday for today, folks. I hope you have a great afternoon. We thank you all for listening. See you again on Friday.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.